This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Place to Be Nation, Greg Diener back with Robert Silver once again to present the final part of our series on the greatest WWE tag teams ever project from Place to Be Nation's list from last season. I know this is a couple months late. I released the second part of this series back in June, but summer, life getting in the way of things. It's summer, you go out, have a good time at the beach and all the... We're done with that stuff as we're heading into the fall, and I'm starting to look at the greatest WWE matches ever project from the TV side of things. So me and Robert are getting ready for that. But let's go back into March when we originally recorded this. We have three teams left to go in from our list, and they include the following: the New Age Outlaws, the Hart Foundation, and Demolition. So we will start right now with my number two team of all time, and that is the New Age Outlaws of Badass Billy Gunn and Road Dogg Jesse James. Here we go.
The New Age Outlaws, and both these guys were teetering on getting tossed out of the WWF before they were put together in, what was it, 1998? Or was it late 97?
Late 97, because I Road Dogg and Billy Gunn were in a feud with each other with Honky Tonk Man, which... Wow.
Oh, that was horrible. Now, their jobs were safe. They were about to get cut, but after Bret Hart left and took a bunch of guys with him, and guys quit left and right, in December of 1997, the WWF was Shawn Michaels, an unproven rock,
their number one guy
was not wrestling, just doing promos in The Rock. So they had to find something else, and an overrated Triple H at the time. So... They put Road Dogg and Mr. Gunn together, and the chemistry was outright. They reminded me of the Midnight Express, because Gunn reminded me so much of Stan Lane physically. He looked like he could be Stan Lane's younger brother, and the Road Dogg, he was the worker of the team, a la Bobby Heaton. That's what they reminded me of. Road Dogg. Like Jim Cornette said several times, there's not an Armstrong that was born that could not work. But Road Dogg was the most complete Armstrong because he had his father's promo ability with his brother's working ability.
And I always liked the two of them were a team. I remember Billy being with the Smoking Guns. You know, that was a very good team in its own right.
Right.
And then Road Dogg when he was the roadie with Jeff Jarrett. I thought they were a great pair together.
Well, what was his name? Jesse James before he became the Road Dogg? Jesse James?
Yeah. Well, he was the roadie and then became the real Double J, Jesse James. And then just became...
the Road Dogg.
Yeah, as a play on him being the roadie before. One of my memorable things about them was... it was a Raw in 1998, in early 98, with Cactus and Chainsaw Charlie. The Raw where they pushed...
Oh! That's the Raw that put them over for the rest of their career.
They pushed them off the dumpster.
The looks of this at all. They were surveying the scene. The Road Dogg and Billy Gunn, wait a minute! Oh, my God! Don't you dare do that!
That was great. And you had the whole locker room breaking kayfabe acting like they were going to attack the Road Dogg and Gunn, and you had McMahon screwing them. What the hell did you do? What the hell did you do? You have the number one, what is the number one heel in the company, Vince McMahon, screaming at these guys for being too big of a heel. That was a great, great, great angle.
And one of my favorite moments from that episode of Monday Night Raw is Jim Ross yelling, "There's people in there! There's people in there! What the hell is so great about that?"
You had Sonny crying. You had the locker room gagging up and beating on Billy Gunn and Road Dogg. It was, that was just great television. And Vince McMahon having to be a moderator and try to broker peace between the Road Dogg and Jesse James and the rest of the locker room, the heels and the faces, because they all idolized Terry Funk and they loved Cactus Jack Mankind. So that was great. And then Triple H and Shawn Michaels the following week was like, "Yeah, you guys have it to be in the Degeneration X. And even though in real life, the Road Dogg and Billy Gunn did not get along with Triple H and Shawn Michaels, they put that to the side and was part of Degeneration X, and they were pushed to the moon. They made the Legion of Doom look like Jabba to the Stars. They had the Monday Night Raw after WrestleMania when X-Pac debuted.
Oh, yes.
And they jumped Cactus Jack and Chainsaw Charlie Terry Funk in the cage, and that was great. That was great. X-Pac, what a great reintroduction. And it was no stopping the New Age Outlaws. They were a tremendous tag team.
Yeah, and putting them with DX was probably the best thing for them because it instantly elevated those two into the main event scene, just being paired with Hunter and China in that group.
And remember, they played a great part in the kidnapping of Stephanie and having her marry Triple H. They were part of that kidnapping. That was a great angle.
Oh, yes. That was something, let me tell you. When you think about the current era, you're going to think the New Day among the acts of this era. When you think about the Attitude Era, one of the first things you think of besides Austin, besides Triple H, besides The Rock, is the New Age Outlaws. They're right in there with them.
What was that catchphrase that Billy Gunn would do? Let's get ready to...
If you're not ready, we've got two words for you, and you know the two words.
Yeah. Oh, that was great. Good. That's what he reminded me of Stan Lee, because when Stan Lee would take the mic, and our manager, Jim Cornette, he was like, and for the millions of, until Michael Buffer put a stop to him, let's get ready to say, he would have to go, I got two words for you.
What an act, and they are among probably one of the top teams in the history of the promotion. So now I think it's time we get into our number ones. Real
two and one. We go into our number two and our number. Oh no! Wait a minute. There's three teams left.
We already did the Bulldogs, which was your number
two. Was that okay? All right. Yes. Yes.
So
I'm looking at your list.
Ones.
Okay. We go into our number ones. We've done ten through two. We go into our number ones, and I'll let you go. Oh, I'll go first. Okay. My all-time favorite wrestler is Bret Hitman Hart. And my favorite tag team of all time are the Hart Foundation. I love the Hart Foundation because they were a perfect mix of the technical workweight wrestler and the strongman. And it was perfect. They had great chemistry because they were brother-in-laws in real life. Jim Neidhart was married to Bret's sister. And, of course, everybody knows Natty, the daughter of Jim Neidhart that watches Wrestling Today and Total Divas. They were a great tag team, and they debuted in March of 1985. Jimmy Hart, it was great. Bret Hart told Pat Patterson, "I got an idea," and Pat Patterson ran with it. Bret Hart, Jim the Anvil Neidhart, and Jimmy Hart, the Hart Foundation. That was, and it made sense to have Greg to have a Valentine because Valentine is a Hart also. So that was great. That was the great Hart Foundation, and you have a six man with Greg Valentine. He continues the Hart. So that was a great idea by Bret Hart, and Pat Patterson went with it. And they were just great from day one. from 1985 to 1991, they were always embroiled in a great upper card feud with another tag team. At the beginning, it was the British Bulldogs. They had some great matches with the Killer Bees. They had great matches with Strikeforce. They were going to have matches with the Can-Am Connection, but I don't think that ever happened because of the breakup. They had great matches with the Islanders. They had great matches with Demolition. They had spectacular matches with the Brainbusters. That SummerSlam match was the best match on that card. They had great matches with the Rockers. Throughout, and finally they lost the title. They lost the titles in one of the worst matches they ever had as a tag team to the Nasty Boys. But that point in time, it was time to move on. It was time for Brett to become a single star because they had teased for so long. He had outgrown tag teams. But for 6 years, from March of 85 to March of 91, when they lost the tag team titles for the last time, they were upper-tier tag team wrestlers. They were two single wrestlers going nowhere when Bret Hart went to Pat Patterson and said, I got this idea, and Pat Patterson ran with it. And Pat Patterson wasn't even the booker at the time. George Scott was. But Patterson had the ear of McMahon, and McMahon greenlit it, and the rest was history.
One of my favorite things was when the Hart Foundation defeated the British Bulldogs in Superstars of 87 to win the tag titles with that dastardly Danny Davis.
Just
screwed the Bulldogs out of the titles, and that led to the great six-man tag with at WrestleMania 3 with the Harts and Danny Davis against the Bulldogs and Tito.
And that was a great match. Of course, five of the six guys are good workers, and Danny Davis doesn't have to do anything but bump and sell.
Yeah, and it was perfect, too, because you had the angle of the Bulldogs got screwed by Danny Davis, and they did a great job retconning Tito getting screwed out of the Intercontinental title when...
Against Macho Man, right, with the brass knucks.
Tights, and it was real. Danny Davis was the referee that night, so he got screwed, too. That was a tremendous match. And then they lost the titles in that year to Tito and Rick Martel and Strikeforce. And eventually, 88, they have the... Well, I'm trying to think. 88 was when Brett had the feud with Bad News. Now,
Right. And after that WrestleMania Battle Royal, they turned Brett face, and he feuded with Bad News. And Jim Neidhart was weird. He was a tweener. Because in some house shows, he wrestled Greg Valentine, and in other house shows, he would wrestle Don Morocco. You got a face and a heel. So you wasn't sure where Neidhart was. You knew Bret Hart was a baby face. They fired Jimmy Hart. They re-team up. They lose to the Hart, to the Brainbusters at SummerSlam. And they're feuding with the god-awful tag team of the Honky Tonk Man and Greg the Hammer Valentine.
What a terrible team that was. Oh, dear God, Greg Valentine with his hair getting dyed black.
Black
hair. Oh,
looking like Roy Orbison. Looking like Roy
Orbison. He did look like Roy Orbison.
Oh, man. Jesse Ventura. Hey, he's a good-looking guy. He looks just like Roy Orbison.
He looked more deader than Roy Orbison. That's what. And I guess, we could segue that to my number one, which was...
Oh, before you continue,
okay.
One of my all-time favorite Saturday main event promos.
Okay.
I forgot which Saturday main event was it. Maybe you remember. Off the top of your head, you might remember. Me and Gene is interviewing the Harts before a match.
Right. Hart Foundation, it must have been a little disconcerting not to know until this very moment which two members of Demolition you were going to face for the tag team title. But, gentlemen, it appears that the pieces of the puzzle have finally fallen into place.
I must admit, it's been a little confusing, but I thought all along it was going to be the two original and most experienced members of Demolition, Axe and Smash.
What about you, Apple? What do you think?
Think? They don't pay me to think. They pay me to be tough like an anvil. Hence the name, right? Right? It never mattered to me because when I get in the ring, I just don't care.
Settle down, Anvil. Settle down. He's a little anxious, and so am I. anxious to once again be the World Wrestling Federation Tag Team Champions. And now, since we only have to worry about two demolition, you can bet that the Hart Foundation, we're gonna make flatliners out of Axe and Crush.
Yeah, Demolition, after the heart attack we're gonna give you, you'll be buying pacemakers by the truckload, baby! Yeah.
Just like Phil Collins says, what we have here are two hearts beating as one.
Yeah.
Let's get back to ringside.
And like Phil Collins says, two hearts, we're two hearts beating as one. I love that.
I actually think that promo was brought up recently on Place to Be Nation.
I love that fucking promo. Well, was it the last Saturday event they were talking about? Was it that?
I think it was the... Oh, God. Now I got to get my phone here. I think it was the last MSG house show they reviewed. The January 23rd, 89.
Oh, yeah, because because my man Scott goes over the top 10 songs of the week. And Phil Collins, that song was number one on the charts. Did he bring up doing that? Because I think I fell asleep during that part.
Yeah,
Did he bring up about how Jim Nahar, that was the great. He said it so matter-of-factly with that great laugh. And just like Phil Collins said, we'll be two hearts beating as one. That was great.
It's even more funnier because Phil Collins did a network special in 1990 with the Ultimate Warrior dressed as with the Two Hearts song playing. If you can find it on YouTube, it's the funniest thing ever.
Oh my God!
Where Ultimate Warrior basically beats the crap out of Phil Collins.
Nah, they would have been better off having Phil Collins singing that song during WrestleMania when the Hart Foundation comes down the ring. Two hearts, it's just one. Phil Collins, one of my all-time favorite pop singers. He's the answer to the trivia question, and you would have never known this. He had the most hit singles in the 1980s, a decade that Madonna, Whitney Houston, Michael Jackson, Prince, and Sade, Bruce Springsteen, all ruled. Phil Collins had the most combined hits. Unbelievable.
And he had the closing theme on Saturday night's main event for many years. Would Take Me Home.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Oh, Phil Collins. All over pop culture.
After these messages, we'll be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these current shows, plus archives of our previous podcasts over the past 8 years, as well by subscribing to our feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others available at PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects and more. Be sure to support our site by using www.placetobenation.com/Amazon while doing your online shopping. And be sure to join us at our forum at bigelow34.proboards.com for all sorts of wrestling, sports, and pop culture discussion each and every day where you can make your voice heard. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
So now let's get to my
number one. Yeah,
which is
a perfect segue because the last team the Hart Foundation beat to win the World Tag Team Titles was Demolition.
Yes, and Demolition, they were formed 1987 initially with Bill Eady, who was it, Moondog Rex or Moondog Spot?
Moondog Rex, Randy Cully.
Okay. And
Originally, it was supposed to be, they reached out to Nikita Koloff for Smash, but Nikita wasn't going because he was just turned face and was in a red hot feud in Crockett. So instead of getting Nikita, they went and got Crusher Khrushchev.
Which was Barry
actually
Dawson.
Which was Barry Dawson. Now, I never understood why Bill Eadie was part of Demolition because he was so fucking old by that time. I mean, but I got to give Bill Eadie credit. I didn't know till maybe a year later that was actually the Masked Superstar because he did none of the Masked Superstar moves. He was just a stomp and kick wrestler. He didn't do any moves.
And I guess that's a good credit to him because
You
have to change his style.
Everybody knew that Moondog Rex was Smash. He got booed out the building. He was fired that same day doing the television taping.
When you think of Demolition, you think about their look and how they would come to the ring. They would dress up in the outfit, the leather outfits with the hockey mask, looking like Jason from Friday the 13th. And
with one of the great theme songs of all time.
Yeah, Rick Derringer's Demolition theme from I guess it's the Pile Driver album. Is that?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's probably one of my favorite albums because it has Coco Beware singing the title song.
Yes, that's fucked up. They got Coco singing the title song of that album, and he's a jobber to the stars.
Well, he certainly
in the video. In the video, he's hanging out with Hulk Hogan. You think he'd get a bigger push?
That video is something else. To be quite honest. That is just one of the most weird. That's one of the most weirdest videos. Actually, that entire Coliseum video with the Pile Driver album is something else. Because I think you got Jive Soul Bro on that album.
You have
Mean Gene singing Rock and Roll Hoochie Coo. Oh.
And you know, I didn't notice until he died. Mean Gene was a rock and roll star before he became an announcer.
Wait a minute, what?
Yes, yes, Google him. He was in a rock band, or it could have been a pop or a doo-wop band, in the 1950s. I'm surprised, and then Meltzer wrote about it in The Observer.
It says he was also a radio host in Minneapolis under the alias of Gene Leader. Gene fronted the band Gene Carroll and the Shades.
There you go. There you go.
Never going to happen on the album In This Corner in 1962. Wow.
The great Brian Last on his Mean Gene Okerlund 605 tribute podcast had the guy who ran the studio. They recorded the song and they played the cut. They played that cut on the show.
Is it ever gonna happen? Is it ever gonna be? Is it ever gonna happen? Maybe that'll be me. Well, it's well, tell me. And I got a funny feeling. The feeling's going round. Got a funny feeling. Maybe I'm out of town.
I gotta listen to that as soon as we're done.
I didn't know until then. I was like, oh shit. He was a singer before he became an announcer. Sort of like Jimmy Hart.
I didn't even think of that. Yeah, that is true. They both were singers before they got into wrestling. Well, Axe and Smash, they were initially paired with Johnny V. And then somewhere along the way, they ended up being paired with the Devious One, Mr. Fuji.
Yeah, because Johnny Valley got fired during that time he was managing them, and so they put him with Mr. Fuji.
And that's probably one of my favorite My favorite manager tag team pairings is Mr. Fuji with the face paint with Demolition.
Mr. Fuji was a horrible manager, but his best work was with Demolition. because he could just blend in as Demolition. The evil one, Mr. Fuji.
The reason why Axe and myself were put on this earth is to demolish people. And it doesn't matter where or when our new manager tells us to demolish them, we do. Isn't that right?
All we have to do to be successful is demolish people. All we have to do to be successful is pay attention to our new manager. That means Rougeau's, Can-Am Connection, Heart Foundation. It doesn't matter who steps in our way. You're going to go down. Because we want to be the number one tag team in professional wrestling. And nobody, absolutely nobody, is going to stand in our way.
Very, very true, Demolition. You make opponents suffer. You will tear into the body. You make the bones crackle, crackle, one piece at a time, under guidance of Mr. Fuji.
And, of course, they end up winning the tag team titles from Strike Force at WrestleMania 4, getting the biggest pop that night.
Look, not only in Atlantic City did they get the biggest pop. I saw that match in Madison Square Garden on a closed circuit with my brother. When Demolition won the tag team title, there was like 10,000 fans watching this on closed circuit. We all jumped up and was cheering hard. They got a major pop at Madison Square Garden. And that was when McMahon saw the idea, yeah, I got to turn this team face eventually.
Yeah, because the summer of 88, the Powers of Pain debuted to challenge Demolition for the titles, and they eventually came in as faces. I remember the Powers of Pain. They came in.
Yeah, who was
Baron von Raschke.
Yeah.
And that didn't last too long, if I recall.
It lasted a month. I didn't understand when they came with SummerSlam with the Baron. I mean, it looked perfect. I was like, oh shit! And then all of a sudden, Baron was gone. And then at Survivor Series, they did a double turn. And you know what? That really fucked up the Powers of Pain. The Demolition got the better of that turn. Yeah. Even though the Powers of Pain got Fuji. They never gave the Powers of Pain the belts. Demolition was going over them. Oh, even 2 against 3. It would be the Powers of Pain and Mr. Fuji against Demolition. And Demolition would still go over.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense to me. Because Mr. Fuji, he has the tag team championships. And all of a sudden, he just goes with the Powers of Pain because Demolition's pissed at him? What?
Didn't make any bad booking. And it ruined the Powers of Pain. They were never the same after that. They were red hot up until that point. They were a hot face team. When they turned heels, the fans already love Demolition. They're not going to pick Demolition. You got two Road Warrior gimmicks. They're going to go with the first one.
Yeah. But in January 89, you have the first Royal Rumble on pay-per-view. And to get over how crazy the Royal Rumble can be, you have Axe and Smash as the first two men in the Royal Rumble match.
The 89 Royal Rumble was the first real good Royal Rumble. That was a very... You had Demolition versus Axe starting off. You had Hulk Hogan eliminating baby faces left and right. Like, what the fuck is Hogan doing? It was the first time you saw Hogan act as a heel. And then when he get dumped, he dumped the Big Boss Man out, even though he's already eliminated? He was acting like a real big shit-faced heel. You were thinking, maybe he's the one that's going to turn against Macho Man, not the other way around. I'm like, look at this shit. And then, you know, him and Macho Man get into a little dispute, and Elizabeth has to break it up. I was like, that 89 Royal Rumble was the first real exciting Royal Rumble. The only negative was having Big John Studd win when he couldn't even move.
Yeah. And also you had the angle with DiBiase buying number 30, which I love.
He buys it off Slick.
Oh man. That was a great rumble. But when we go into 89, they have a feud with the Twin Towers. They have a feud with the Brainbusters. They, of course, as we mentioned, they lose the belts on the May 89 edition of Saturday Night's Main Event in the 2 out of 3 falls match.
Which did not make sense because one of the falls was a disqualification, and you're not supposed to count that towards a title win, but they overlooked it.
I don't know. Jack Tunney was not paying attention that day.
Didn't make sense because a year prior to that, the same thing happened with the Bulldogs against Demolition, where they won 2 out of 3 falls. One of them was a disqualification. And Jesse's like, oh, no, they don't get the belts, man. They don't get the belts, McMahon. No, no, no. One of them was a disqualification. But this one, they overlook it. They might have had to re-edit what Jesse said, because I'm sure when he first looked at it, when first broadcast, he probably brought that up. And Vince was like, Jesse, we got to do a do-over.
And then SummerSlam 89, Demolition teamed with Hack. This is when Hacksaw was the king, and they teamed against Andre and the Twin Towers in a six-man match, which is terrible, but I wanted to bring it up because there's a fan in the front row that's on camera holding a sign that says, Demolition will topple the Twin Towers.
Yes, yes, yeah, I remember that. Yes.
I don't know if he had a TARDIS, if he came in from like the future to 1989 to watch that pay-per-view. I don't know, but geez, that is so horrible in 2000.
You know what? I gotta look at the network and see if they allow that to still be shown. Because
because
if you remember, Greg, Notorious B.I.G., Biggie Smalls' first hit had I'm Blowing Up Like the World Trade. And today, when they play that song on the radio, that part is bleeped out.
Understandable.
Yeah. Yeah, but he came out with that song in 94. The world, he's talking about the first Twin Tower explosion of 93.
One.
Yeah, the 93 one. But I wonder if the WWF allows a demolition. We'll topple the Twin Towers. Now I've got to go back and watch that SummerSlam just for that match.
So eventually, taped in October, but in November of 89, they win the belts back from the Brainbusters on Superstars, and then they have the feud with the Colossal Connection, where the Andre and Haku, as we mentioned, they win the belts late in the year for the to end Demolition's second reign, and then at WrestleMania 6, Demolition makes history, three-peating as WWF Tag Team Champion. And I remember because they make a Gorilla mentions the term three-peat. Now remember, this is 1990. The Chicago Bulls have not three-peated as NBA champions yet.
But the three-peat was already a term because Pat Riley coined it in 1987 during the post-game celebration of the Lakers beating the 1988. 1987 after they beat.
He makes the prediction.
No, 1988, after they beat the Detroit Pistons. My bad. In 1988, after they beat the Pistons, he makes a prediction. We're going for a three-peat next year. That was the first time anybody ever coined that term in sports, three-peat.
And the Lakers end up,
They got clobbered by the Pistons
in
89.
Which was
but, I mean, Magic Johnson was hurt the entire series. Pistons would have still won because the Pistons were a great defensive team and Isaiah was at the top of his game and Joe Dumars was Mr. Clutch.
Lambeer.
And Dennis Rodman on the defense were monsters. But a healthy Magic Johnson, the greatest point guard of all time, that's a series. It only went 5 games. It would have been much more competitive.
It would have been 6 at least.
Yes.
Demolition, they win the belts back for the third time. And this is when they introduce Crush to the team. And this
because Bill Eadie was having physical problems. I think he might have had a heart attack during this point in time. And he became more of a manager than a wrestler. And then they finally lose the titles to the Hart Foundation. And that was the end. And then they get jobbed out to the Legion of Doom Road Warriors.
Pretty much the end of the team. But that SummerSlam match with Brett, Jim, and Smash and Crush, that is maybe one of my favorite SummerSlam matches of all time.
And you know what? That's one of the most underrated matches in the history of the Federation, the tag team, especially when it comes to tag teams. They don't talk about how good that match was. Brett worked and Jim worked their ass off, and Crush and Khrushchev had to work as hard as he did because Crush was very green. And then the Road Warriors played a part, the Legion of Doom played a part in that finish as well. That was a well-booked, well-executed match.
Yeah, and actually, one thing I want to mention, at SummerSlam last year in Brooklyn, Natalya actually, right after Anvil passed away, she wore Jim Neidhart's jacket from that night to the ring that night for the Ronda Rousey.
Wow. Where was SummerSlam 90 held at?
The Spectrum.
The Spectrum, okay. Because 88 was the Garden, 89 was East Rutherford.
Yeah, and 90 was Spectrum, 91 back the Garden, and then 92 they went to London.
Yeah, for the first few years it was East Coast based, which only makes sense. McMahon was smart whenever he started a pay-per-view to keep it on his side, where he knew his fan base was the biggest.
Yeah, because the first two Survivor Series I remember, they were in Richfield at the Coliseum.
Cleveland.
Yeah, in Cleveland.
Yeah, Cleveland. Yeah.
Which, by the way, the Richfield Coliseum is now like a forest. Did you know that?
No, I didn't know.
I have a friend who's a big Cleveland Cavaliers fan. He told me, the Richfield Coliseum's now a forest.
And they destroyed Memorial Stadium, too, where the Browns and the Indians used to play, right? That's no longer around.
A municipal stadium in Cleveland, yeah, that's no longer. I mean, that's long gone, too, so.
Yeah. I mean, they were like the worst places, home fields, for any team. The municipal stadium and the Richfield Coliseum. Oh, my God. They were the worst, both in Cleveland.
Yeah, there'd be many years where the Indians games where you'd get, like, less than 10,000 people in an 80,000-seat building.
Hey, they had...
Hey, the Browns were pretty good in that period, though, in the 80s.
Well, even when the Browns were bad, the fans came to the games. They always had at least 70,000 show up. The Browns were like the Saints. Even when they were horrible, fans came to the games.
Eventually, Axe leaves the team. They paired back up with Mr. Fuji. Now, I just want to mention this before I wrap up on Demolition. Now, in 1991, they have a match with Tenryu and Kitao, but I wanted to mention where they get jobbed by Tenryu and Kitao, which is sad to watch. But I wanted to mention it because there's this funny interview segment with Alex Trebek and Regis Philbin at WrestleMania 7 where Alex Trebek is interviewing Demolition, and then Regis is interviewing Tenryu and Kitao, and the only way Regis can communicate with Tenryu and Kitao is by mentioning Japanese car manufacturers.
Unfucking believable.
But I mean, I find it hilarious that that Demolition was doing an interview with Alex Trebek, because Alex Trebek at this time, he was not only people forget in 91, he was not only hosting Jeopardy, but he was on NBC. He was hosting Plastic Concentration and To Tell the Truth. So he had three.
All right, he was the. What was my man's name that did the Dating Game and a couple other shows at the same time?
Jim
what
Lane?
Was my man?
Jim Lane.
No, after him. No,
oh,
after
Bob
him.
Bob Eubanks.
After him. Bob? No, was it Bob Eubanks? No. Was there somebody that did like a recent version of it, like in the 90s, early 2000s? Chuck Woolery. Chuck Woolery at one time was like host of four or five shows. Now he can't even get arrested.
Oh, yeah. Yup, indeed. Demolition, what can I say? One of the best tag teams of all time. One of the best acts in the company's history. They don't really get mentioned a lot because, except, you know, recently when the New Day broke their record for the longest time.
Because Bill Eady and Randy Cully have had a lifelong feud with the WWF. They've been to court. Matter of fact, Cully and Eady won the rights to the name Demolition.
Oh, good for them.
They've wrestled independent shows as Demolition. Oh, Randy Cully said that was his idea. It wasn't Pat Patterson or McMahon's idea. It was his idea for Demolition. And since him and Bill Eady were original Demolition, they sought the proof and they got it. They have the rights to the name Demolition. They're not in the WWE Hall of Fame because of that lifelong feud. And These guys are elderly men now. They're not young. They're old men. I hope they can find a way to make amends so they get their proper recognition in the WWE Hall of Fame. Real quickly, they were the number three team on the Place to Be Nation final result. Hart Foundation being number two. And their number one team, and I got no argument with this, even though I don't understand why they were left off a couple of ballots. The Hardy Boys, number one, and I can't argue.
Yeah, it's I can't argue with the result, a good result. And, well, now we're moving on to the greatest matches list. And that's...
And Greg, before you continue with that, I want, for the 51 people, the 49 other people other than us that voted, I got to congratulate them for looking at the WWE, just like they did last year with the WWE's all-time greatest wrestlers, and not just focusing on the last 10 years like a lot of polls do. They looked at the entirety of the federation, and you had a great mix of 80s, 90s, and today. Last year in the top 10, I believe only Cena was in the top 10 from the last 10 years. And in this ballot, only the New Day. I mean, the Usos. The Usos. New Day was in the top 10 also?
Yep. So you had two teams from, but I mean, it's the two best teams from today.
Well, I can't argue with the Usos and New Day being in the top 10. All right, I can't. So I give kudos to the voters. They did a great job like they did last year. And I know that next year there'll probably be a lot more voters. And I'll give it back to you. And you talk about their poll that's about to go up for the greatest matches in the history of the WWE.
When we talk about it, hopefully next year, that is going to be probably the toughest, because that means now I'm going to have to watch 100. I'm going to have to watch 100 or more matches.
But it's, ladies and gentlemen, I used to host a podcast on Blog Talk Radio with my friend Logan called Pro Wrestling Opinion: The Greatest Matches in Wrestling History. I have a lot of those podcasts that you can go back and listen and hear about what we thought about those matches. A lot of those matches will be on my ballot because I reviewed a lot of WWF matches through the years. It's going to be very tough to come up with a top 100, Greg. I agree with you. There's so many greats. Now, I know my top five, nothing's going to stop me from my top five. I'm not going to reveal that right now. I don't want to prejudice anybody. But I know my top five. But when it gets to after 30 or 40, there's so many matches in the same on the same level. You could easily, Greg, do a top 300, 400. This year there was like 399 votes, people that got votes. I could see 800 to 1,000 for these matches getting votes.
I mean, matches is a whole other story. It's very subjective.
You got many more matches than tag teams and wrestlers.
Yes, to cover that, where in the tag list you'd only have to consider a team maybe if they only had like one good match.
If you look at the great wrestlers in the history of the WWF, you know Bruno, Hogan, Savage, Michaels, Cena, Bret Hart. These guys have multiple great matches. A guy like Cena or Shawn Michaels or Bret Hart, they easily have 50 to 60 all-time great matches apiece.
Oh, yeah.
So think about that when you start voting. Think about that.
Yeah, you could have a top 100 where like 50 or 60 wrestlers, like 60 matches are from one guy, realistically.
Think about it. If you did a greatest match in the history of Bret Hart, you could easily come up with 70 to 80 matches. Look at the multiple DVDs that have come out on just his singles and tag team matches. You could say the same thing about Shawn Michaels. You could say the same thing about John Cena. These guys, since they came to the WWF, throughout their careers in the WWF, were the highlights. We just gave great match, had great match after great match after great match. Bret Hart was in the WWF from 1984 to 1997. Shawn Michaels was in the WWF from 1988 to 1998, and then from 2002 to 2010, all right? Had multiple great matches. Triple H has had many great. Undertaker, every year he'd have a five-star match at WrestleMania. So this is going to be the most difficult poll ever to come up with 100 because there's so many great matches. I know my top five. I'm not veering from it. They're set in stone. But when I get to 30, 40, 50, and I got to look at all these, I got to look at all these matches again. How do I tell? It's flip a coin time, baby. Flip a coin time.
Do I put this as number 58 or do I put this as number 59?
And next year, when we do our top 10 for this show, it could go 7-8 hours because we might have 3 or 4 matches the same. Maybe. We might. I don't know. We might. At best. Yeah.
I have an idea for a couple matches I want to put on the top 10 for reasons, but I'm gonna wait until I get, because everyone right now is nominating. I'm not even gonna bother nominating a match. I'm just gonna let it.
You don't have to, because eventually somebody's gonna come up with it. It's gonna be on the list. Eventually somebody will mention it. I think at the beginning they forgot to mention to nominate Bret Hart versus Ricky Steamboat from the Boston Garden. That's gonna be on the That was a spectacular. I mean, there's so many. They did nominate Bret Hart versus Randy Savage for Saturday Main Event November 1987. That's going to be on us eventually. They just look how – you don't have to nominate anything. It's going to eventually be put on that list. But just think about breaking that shit down. Oh, my God.
And, what
and then when you do get – and what a great multiple DVD set you could make when the results of that top 100 comes out.
Well, I was going to say, it's great that we're living in an era with the WWE Network and DVDs and all, that you can just try to find a match on the network, or if not, you might have the DVD of the match somewhere.
Or YouTube, or Daily Motion. You either way, you got 4 avenues. You got your DVD collection, you got WWE Network, you got YouTube, you got Daily Motion. Of those 4 options, you'll be able to see any of those matches being nominated. And kudos to Scott and Justin for making it TV and pay-per-view only matches. Because think of the list, how big the list was if we just talk about matches you saw at a house show.
Yeah, I'm guessing MSG TV house shows would count on this, or...
It does count. There's some matches that have been nominated.
Oh, good.
But remember, MSG house shows, there's only been 2 that have been televised since 1992.
Yeah, so anything. Yeah. But as long as I can put Rick Rude and Roddy Piper from 1989 on the list, I'm fine.
That's the cage match. That's right. Or the 2 boot camp matches. The one with Iron Sheik and Slaughter and Hogan and Sergeant Slaughter. Sergeant Slaughter boot camp.
Oh, yes. Yeah. We talked about that last show. I love that Hogan Slaughter boot camp match so much.
Yeah, so there's a ton to look at. And, man, I just want to say, you could check out my old podcast. It's still on Apple iTunes. Just check on the Pro Wrestling Opinion, Greatest Wrestling Matches. I covered a lot. And we did over 70 greatest wrestling matches of all time. And we covered all the territories, but the WWF being that Logan and I are both from New York, was covered heavily, and you have a lot of those matches that are candidates and on there, so you can check that out. And check out Scott and Justin's Place to Be Nation retro shows on the Garden instead of Main Event and pay-per-views, as they've covered a lot of those shows as well.
God bless Scott and Justin. I had fun doing the Greatest Wrestler Project. I had a lot of fun doing this project, and I'm sure I'm going to have a lot of fun doing the Greatest Match Project too. So, Robert, it was fun to do this again, and can't wait to do this again next year, hopefully.
No, I just got to make sure I don't have a sore throat, because I'll be talking a lot on that one. Oh my God, that last year our greatest wrestler ever was like a 5, and you cut it into 3 or 4 podcasts. This year, you probably only have to do 2 because it's been a little bit under 3 hours. Now, next year,
it'll be
a record.
It'll be like the Lord of the Rings movies. We'll have like an extended edition for like 1 minute.
I remember as a kid, my parents forced me to watch Go with the Wind, and I'm like, I want to go to sleep. It's so long.
I don't. I don't blame you.
And it was boring. It was, I was like, what the fuck are people? I was 8 years old watching Gone with the Wind, and it was on network television. So Gone with the Wind is like a 3.5-hour movie without commercials.
Two nights.
Right? So that mode, they showed it from 8 to 11 one night, and I think from 9 to 11 the next night. Oh, God! That was brutal!
Well, they saved the best part for the end when Clark Gable tells off Vivian Leigh.
It was like watching a Luthes George Carpentier match, Edwin Carpentier match, where Luthes has Carpentier in a headlock for 20 minutes. Good, turn this shit off! I want to go to bed! But once again, had a great time, Greg. Shout out to Justin and Scott, and keep up the good work. And Greg, I will talk to you a year from now. Will be very quick.
Yes.
Time is flying.
All right. Well, for Robert, this is Greg saying thank you for listening to the podcast, and it's a good night from here. So long, everybody.
Shamu, the killer whale. And then we get, I don't know, who's ever the current black athlete. And then we get, like, Miss America.
Vanessa Williams?
Nah, she'd never do it.
I didn't think so.
Wrestling always
has
a point. Got a point.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Rock and wrestling.
And a bunch of midgets.
No, you need the champ. You need
the champ?
Of wrestling.
Hulk Hogan.
No, he's not the champ. Who is it?
Ultimate Warrior.
Ultimate Warrior, Phil Collins, and the gorgeous ladies of wrestling. A bunch of spandex-clad, sweating, husky
women. I got it. Phil Collins versus the Ultimate Warrior. Came up with a stupid idea. You have any more moronic suggestions?